Welcome to Breast Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Ann Partridge, and to begin, she commented on a single-arm phase 2 adjuvant trial in patients with HER2-positive disease that was conducted at her institution, Dana-Farber, evaluating the combination of trastuzumab and paclitaxel. To begin, Dr. Partridge commented on the background for this unique study.
So once the adjuvant trastuzumab studies and results became available for all of us to improve the care of our patients, we started adding on trastuzumab for everyone who had HER2-positive breast cancer and met criteria for the adjuvant trials, which, as I'm sure most people are aware of, included node-positive disease or high-risk node-negative disease. And given the superior results from getting trastuzumab, we all wanted to get trastuzumab for every patient with HER2-positive disease. And yet, at what point does one not give trastuzumab? So what we increasingly saw in our clinic was women coming in with a small node negative, therefore not as high risk HER2-positive cancer, especially if it was ER-positive. And we were all running into the dilemma of to give or not give trastuzumab, because otherwise we might not have given this woman chemotherapy. And so increasingly we were kind of wringing our hands about this, and we were all coming up with kind of made-up cocktails and slapping trastuzumab onto chemo light. And there are lots of examples of things people were doing, and we were treating people, we would call it Hera style, because Hera, as I'm sure you recall, gave the chemo first, and then you gave trastuzumab later. But nobody liked that very much because, of course, in the North American trials, the trastuzumab given with chemotherapy was a little bit better than doing the trastuzumab after the chemotherapy. And so in light of all of that and wanting to collect additional data about the pros and cons and value of trastuzumab for these lower-risk HER2-positive cancers, our group, led by Eric Weiner and my colleague Sarah Tolaney, came up with the APT or APT trial, which was designed to answer, at least in a prospective fashion, the potential value of trastuzumab for women with lower risk HER2-positive cancers.
One of the things I thought was really, in a way, the trial seemed kind of straightforward, but I thought was really innovative was, you know, it was just a single arm phase 2 study. You know, we're used to thinking about adjuvant trials always being these huge randomized study. What was the thinking there in trying to do it that way?
So there was a lot of thought and back and forth that went into the design of the APT trial. And the main consideration was getting some information to inform care and being able to accrue, recognizing that many people were going to take trastuzumab if they wanted it. And we might not be able to actually do a feasible trial because people would live in one camp or another, and you'd never be able to do a randomized trial in this group, because it would take you 20 years to get all the data.
Although, I mean, you could have compared it to, you know, an anthracycline taxane type regimen, I guess. But, you know, when it was all said and done, I think you all were proven to be 100% correct.
Yeah, it was a gamble. I think it was a gamble.
It was a total gamble. And I think the way it played out, it completely worked. And maybe if you'd seen different results, it might not have worked. So maybe you can talk about what you all saw.
Yeah, so what they found, which has been fantastic and I think a real boon for the cancer community as a whole, was that there was an extremely small rate of recurrence overall. There were 10 recurrence events overall and only 2 distant recurrence events at a median follow-up of somewhere around 3 years.
And that's like over 400 people.
And over 400 people. And most of the events were contralateral or recurrence in the ipsilateral breast. And again, only 2 distant recurrent events. Now, it's pretty short-term follow-up and we need to watch people over time, but they did compare rigorously, at least in their power calculations and in their safety profile, to historical controls. And this was well below what was the safety cutoff, the early stopping limits.
Actually, the interesting thing is when you finally see the data, to me, what it brings up is, I mean, obviously, these are great results. You know, you cannot argue with it. But the only thing really you could say is, did everybody really need to be treated? I mean, there were not a small number of people in that trial with T1A tumors. You know, you can make an argument maybe they didn't even need to be treated.
So I think you're absolutely right. And we didn't define in that study the absolute lower limit of where people should be treated. And I have no doubt that there was some overtreatment in that trial. On the flip side, when you look at the overall pool of patients with HER2-positive stage 1 disease, we saw dramatically lower rates of recurrence than one would expect, at least historically. But again, in the T1A range, we're not sure how far we moved the needle.
You know, another issue here is the toxicity. And there, again, we have indirect comparisons. People think about something like TCH. They'll think about an anthracycline taxane regimen. What's your sort of gut impression, having seen a lot of people having received all three of these approaches? What's just from a, if a patient were to ask you, you know, just tell me what the difference is going to be in the experience. What's the big differentiating feature in terms of paclitaxel trastuzumab?
Yeah, and I've treated numerous people with all of these regimens, and it is night and day in terms of the toxicities with regard to, you know, just, you know, first, it's duration. So TH was a 12-week regimen as opposed to TCH or ACTH, where you'd go on for a lot longer. You know, obviously you're adding on the trastuzumab for the full year, but in terms of the cytotoxic chemotherapy, much shorter. Second, when you have only one drug with a trastuzumab backbone, you're only going to get the toxicity of that one drug. So we're all familiar with the serious risks of the anthracyclines and the AC regimen in terms of cardiotoxicity, which is low but serious, as well as the secondary leukemia risk. You know, these are the kind of what you weigh, especially when you're talking about small potential benefits relatively when you're talking about small tumors. You know, TCH, a great alternative, is extraordinarily toxic in terms of a person's day-to-day quality of life because of the neutropenia, the fatigue, the nausea that many women experience, and the neuropathy, of course. In TH, we didn't see that same level of fatigue. We did not see the same level of risk in terms of long-term late effects. There was neuropathy, and there were other kind of quality of life impacting side effects like fatigue. But in my clinical experience, it was not remotely as high as one would see with one of the more standard kitchen sink regimens, as I like to call them.
So can you comment on the follow-up to this trial, the so-called ATTEMPT study, looking at T-DM1 compared to paclitaxel trastuzumab in the adjuvant setting?
So the ATTEMPT trial, I think, is really exciting in the follow-on trial to the APP trial, and it's designed to even further reduce toxicity and potentially improve efficacy for a low-risk HER2-positive patient. And so the ATTEMPT trial randomizes women to T-DM1 compared to the control arm or the new control arm or standard in this situation, which is paclitaxel and trastuzumab. And we're measuring the rates of amenorrhea as well as multiple other toxicities, both that one would expect from a taxane-based regimen as well as those that are known to be associated with T-DM1. And of course, disease outcomes are the main outcome. And this is a more conventional randomized controlled trial, so we will have the comparator arm of the new standard.
You've talked about seeing people with HER2-positive disease receive a lot of different kinds of regimens in terms of, you know, how it affects them at a quality of life and lifestyle level. How do you see T-DM1 fitting in? I hear such, you know, positive things about this agent, and particularly compared to conventional chemotherapy.
So T-DM1, I think, is really the beginning of what I hope to be an explosion of therapies that allow us to have really good disease control and obviously obliteration in the adjuvant setting, while at the same time not wreaking havoc on the rest of the body. So T-DM1 is kind of, I think, the ultimate pro-patient survivorship chemotherapy drug in that, you know, it really is what I would think of as, I think of it as a Trojan horse kind of story where, you know, you send in the trastuzumab that's not so toxic, but we sneak in the chemotherapy. And I'd like to see more and more of those. And I know there are many others in development. And the toxicities, of course, reflect generally what you would see with trastuzumab alone and then a little bit more. And I think T-DM1 is very exciting. I think right now what we're struggling with and developing studies to further address is, you know, where in the armamentarium should it fall? because we have many other competing regimens that are quite good as well, especially, you know, pertuzumab and in the HER2-directed therapies. So we're struggling with that. And I think the other big issue is in the adjuvant setting. And I'm hopeful that some of the adjuvant studies will be positive and show us that we can add these kinds of regimens in and get it approved and paid for, and because it improves how patients do in the long run, along with improving the toxicities.
Have you seen any real quality? I mean, I know there's, you know, issues with the platelet counts and liver function tests you have to watch, but in terms of actual quality of life impact, anything that you can identify in your patients that T-DM1 causes?
That is directly attributable to the T-DM1?
At least in your mind.
No, it's pretty well tolerated. I've seen some toxicities as part of studies, but usually, in my experience, it's been the other drugs. So for the most part, the T-DM1 is very well tolerated, as are most of these antibody therapies.
Let's move on to talk about your patients, beginning with your 36-year-old lady.
Sure. So these are actually real patients. And the first is a 36-year-old woman who presented in the middle of a twin pregnancy at 32 weeks with a breast mass. And they delivered her actually when she was due, which was only a couple weeks later, 35 weeks. The poor lady had to undergo both a C-section and a vaginal delivery for different reasons because of what was happening at the end. And she got a biopsy at that time, a day or so after, that showed triple negative breast cancer. And clinically, the mass was at least 3 centimeters. The triple negative breast cancer was high grade, as one might expect. And she saw me for consultation for what to do. I think this case brings up many, many, many issues related to young women's breast cancer, as well as how does one manage a large triple negative breast cancer these days, especially with the new data with regard to, you know, the platinums, and should we be putting that on earlier in the course of someone's care, or is that something that we still only give in the metastatic setting?
You know, one of the issues here, obviously, is, you know, sort of the timing of the delivery and the timing of chemotherapy. What have we learned about this? There have been, you know, a number of series reported in the literature, and this has been widely discussed. What's your overall conclusion about, you know, how to approach this strategically, and what did you do with this lady?
Yeah, so I think strategically first, when we read the literature, I think we have to be aware that pregnancy-associated breast cancer has been defined in different ways by different folks. So I like to refer to this case as breast cancer during pregnancy, which is different than pregnancy-associated breast cancer, because that's breast cancer that forms shortly after a pregnancy. And that's what many of the researchers are now doing. So for a person who's diagnosed with breast cancer during pregnancy, like this case, you really have to bring out the multidisciplinary team to think about how to manage it. This lady was further along, so it was much easier to say, let's deliver her at her due date. A couple weeks here and there is not going to make a difference, and then we'll get her going. So her timing was great. When it gets really trickier is when you find someone in the first trimester or the second trimester. They've got a lot of time to go with the pregnancy, and so you really need to think about what the best options are for mom as well as for fetus, and whether or not it makes sense for that woman, based on both her preference and values, as well as optimal breast cancer treatment, to continue the pregnancy. That's when it gets quite tricky. For this lady, I think that part was easier. You know, the major issue that comes up in cases like this is she at greater risk of hearing from her breast cancer again just by virtue of the fact that she was diagnosed during a pregnancy? And we used to think that that was a horrible thing. Increasingly, and better studies being done, particularly from MD Anderson and now coming from Belgium and other groups in Europe, once you control for age, disease, you know, triple negative, and stage, it does not appear that women diagnosed during pregnancy do clearly worse. But on average, they do worse, because they're more likely to be diagnosed with larger breast cancer because of, you know, it's more difficult to diagnose a breast cancer during pregnancy in a swollen pregnant breast. A, they have more delays. These women are not being screened. And by virtue of the fact that they're all young women who are more likely to get these triple negative breast cancer or HER2 positive breast cancer. More and more data are actually coming out that young women are more likely to have luminal B breast cancer, HER2 positive breast cancer, and triple negative breast cancer than their older counterparts, whether or not there's something unique to young women's breast cancer that's really just an age-focused thing, I have my doubts. There's lots of studies that are looking at that, and right now it's not clear.
So I'm curious what actually happened with this lady, but before you tell me, she has a triple negative tumor, but I'm curious if there's any updates available in terms of safety of anti-HER therapy in pregnancy. There's kind of been this thought not to use trastuzumab. Is that still the case? What about pertuzumab, T-DM1, TKIs?
So the company that makes pertuzumab and trastuzumab is currently actually, and they presented a poster on this last year, is currently tracking all in utero exposures as much as they can through a program called the Mother Risk Program that is looking at exposure in utero to trastuzumab originally, and then when pertuzumab came on the market, they added that, and they're tracking it. And right now, there is a black box warning on trastuzumab, and I assume pertuzumab, that contraindicates the use of it during pregnancy. And that's because there were reports of oligohydramnios, which is, you know, less fluid than you'd like in the amniotic sac, which can lead to bad fetal outcomes, including fetal demise. And so avoidance of those antibody therapies is prudent, and it's contraindicated at this time. Does that mean that exposure to trastuzumab in utero is a guaranteed cause of oligohydramnios? No. And there are reports of babies being delivered safely after exposure to trastuzumab. But in general, it's not something that we would want to expose a fetus to at this point.
T-DM1, TKIs?
So I am not aware of any reports of T-DM1 exposure in utero.
Sort of seems like a real bad idea.
It sounds like a really bad idea to me, and I wouldn't want to test that one. And that brings up the point of there's probably a real lack of reporting here. Right? A lot of bias going on, most likely. And in terms of the TKIs, I am sure there have been in utero exposures. And I also think that that's an area where I wouldn't want to test it. So generally prudent to avoid pregnancy when one's on any of these therapies. You know, the good news is, at least in breast cancer, we do have a reasonable experience with drugs, the conventional drugs like, you know, AC. We're getting an increasing experience with taxanes in pregnancy. And to date, they appear to be reasonably safe, all of it when given after the first trimester and after fetal development, for the most part, has taken place, organ development. And so it can be given fairly safely later on in pregnancy, recognizing that, you know, it's still not a spectator sport, and there are still many, many risks, both from chemo and a pregnancy, and there are risks to particularly the delivery. And there does appear from our group and others to be a potential greater risk of preterm labor or small fetal size, but not necessarily enough to force someone to make decisions based on that.
So I want to ask you how you treated her, but first I got to ask, when did she deliver? Because I think when it occurred might affect how she was treated.
So this lady presented at 32 weeks and was already scheduled to deliver at 35.
No, I mean, when, like, what was the date?
Oh, she actually delivered about a month ago.
Ah, okay. So that makes it a great question, because I'm curious, because I keep trying to figure out what people think about the CALGB trial of preoperative neoadjuvant therapy that, you know, looked at carboplatin that was presented at San Antonio. I don't know. First of all, I assume this lady maybe got neoadjuvant therapy post-delivery?
Yeah, so she actually just signed on to another study.
Oh, another study.
So Okay. We did talk about standard, and we talked about study options when I saw her. And we've got a number of studies for her that I talked to her about. And we, you know, we reviewed the CLGB data, and we reviewed the standard I would give someone generally in a preoperative setting, which right now is still ACT, but the consideration of whether or not we should be adding carbo to that with the TC regimen. As I'm sure you'll recall, in the Lisa Carey study from CLGB, the winner of that arm was actually the Bev arm with TC. And the question is it worth that kind of toxicity? I don't think most of us agree that that's the best way to go right now outside of a trial. And so our group has decided that if we feel that someone needs a platinum upfront outside of a trial, we will consider it, but as a rule, we're still feeling as if, given there's no long-term outcomes from the use of the platinum in the preoperative setting, we're generally not doing it outside of a trial unless we feel that it's, you know, they're not responding to something or there are other reasons why we can't give them a standard regimen.
So I'm really curious about what kind of trial she was in. I don't know if you mentioned her BRCA status.
So you bring up a perfect point. So we have two trials right now for which this lady would have been a candidate. One is for women who are BRCA1 and 2 carriers, and it's called the INFORM trial, and it's led by my colleague Nadine Tung at the BI Deaconess. And this study is for women who are mutation carriers. So you have to get them tested pretty quickly because it's a pre-op trial. And fortunately, the company that tests right now is doing a great job turning it around. We test patients, and if they're a candidate, meaning they have a mutation and want to be on trial, the study randomizes women to cisplatin versus AC as the pre-op therapy. And the main outcome is looking at PathCR and response rates at surgery. And then we give them the complementary additional standard therapy out back that we want to give. If a patient is not a mutation carrier, we just opened another study for women with triple negative breast cancer only. And that study is comparing cisplatin again in the triple negative setting to paclitaxel in the pre-op setting. So we have two options for someone who walks in with a triple negative breast cancer. If they are BRCA1 or 2 positive, they can consider the INFORM trial. If they're BRCA negative, then they can consider this study comparing cisplatin for non-mutation carriers to paclitaxel. And the reason that paclitaxel was chosen as the pre-op is to compare a pure one drug to one drug, trying to get at the efficacy of cisplatin. And of course, this has biomarker correlative studies. We get a biopsy before therapy, and then they have a tissue taken at surgery to look at the differences in terms of tumor response as well as resistance at surgery.
So I'm curious about your 38-year-old woman with a history of mantle irradiation for Hodgkin lymphoma. In our lymphoma series, of course, a huge area of debate is whether or not you need to radiate all these people. This woman obviously was treated in the past. What happened?
Yeah, so this is a lady who's a perfect example of well-intentioned iatrogenesis. So this poor lady, when she was a teenager, had mantle irradiation for Hodgkin's, and she also had a splenectomy. And, you know, that was obviously the du jour therapy for young women when they were coming up as teenagers with Hodgkin's. And then about 2 years ago, you know, almost 15 years later, the poor woman developed tonsillar cancer, which in retrospect, they've attributed to her radiation. And she went through surgery for that. And as an aside, she actually had a bleeding vessel during her surgery for which she almost bled out and ended up in the ICU for several days. So obviously that can happen in any given surgery, but this poor woman had been through all that. And she was going and getting her follow-up good serial breast imaging as a Hodgkin's survivor at a young age. So she was getting alternating mammograms and MRIs, and she was found on the mammogram to have a new breast lesion in our survivorship clinic, where we see multidisciplinary, you know, we see patients who are either sent there because they're, you know, don't need to be in the oncology clinic anymore, or in particular, we see survivors of multiple cancers so that their care is streamlined. And she was found to have this abnormality. She was sent to me for further workup and was found to have a decent sized 2.4 centimeter stage 2 by virtue of that alone cancer. And she also had one of 5 sentinel nodes revealing just a little more than a micrometastasis. So the tumor was in the node 0.25 centimeters. And of course, a micrometastasis is 0.2 or smaller. And so when I saw this lady, she didn't want any more surgery for the reasons that, you know, what she's been through in her life. Radiation was not an option for her in general because she's already suffered from radiation. And of course, that has lots of risks to do it again. Although, of course, it did save her life originally. And she also wasn't dying to get chemotherapy. And I was looking and saying, if she'd never had this history, and by the way, her tumor was low grade. So she had a low grade ER-PR positive HER2 negative tumor with a small amount in 1 of 5 nodes. So she brought up a lot of complexities beyond her survivorship issues and background. You know, this is where treating the whole patient is really important because you might knee-jerk to give a young, healthy person, you know, with this story, chemo, but at the same time, how much is chemo going to add in a low-grade ER-positive cancer situation? And then on top of that, this lady is a person who's already seen a lot of cancer therapy, granted no cytotoxic therapy, but she knows that our treatments more than anybody can cause harm. And she wanted to know what's in it for me, what's the value. So we actually got an oncotype on this lady and her oncotype was 10, corresponding to a low risk score, which of course brought up the, okay, how much value is chemo going to add? maybe nothing. You know, and that would be the suggestion based on that oncotype. But it made for a very kind of interesting, I presented this lady at Tumor Board, and based on her preferences, I can tell you what she elected to do, but there was some hand-wringing and still is on the part of her surgeon who felt like she needed a dissection, even though it's one of five lymph nodes and it was only a micromet. We actually plugged her situation into the MD Anderson algorithms as well as the Memorial Sloan Kettering algorithm. And the MD Anderson one gave her a 12% risk of more nodal disease. The Memorial Sloan Kettering one gave her a 5% risk of more nodal disease. So we did have some, you know, at least algorithm information to inform that decision. But it was a tricky one.
So you didn't say what happened, but I'm guessing she decided not to get chemo, is now on tamoxifen?
You got it. So no further surgery. She's on tamoxifen. We may actually suppress her ovaries, and recognizing full well that I'm actually part of a guideline panel from ASCO that said that's not the standard. But I do offer some of my younger patients that as an alternative to chemotherapy, recognizing that we're not sure what, if anything, it adds to tamoxifen. But at the same time, we have data that it alone is as good as CMF chemotherapy in premenopausal women. So sometimes I offer it.
In terms of oncotype, in what situations, if any, do you order the assay in a patient with positive nodes?
Depends on the patient. So certainly an older patient, I'm willing to consider a few positive nodes, you know, a la the SWOG trial that Kathy Albane led and the analysis looking at oncotype in that group where it was 1 to 3 positive nodes. I think once you get above that, the risks are higher and it's much harder to justify not giving chemotherapy because it might add and there's still some uncertainty. And of course, we await the RX ponder results ultimately. I think for, you know, a young person, it's probably a little lower threshold to give chemotherapy, although I try not to base treatments on age. Those people are going to have a lot of ovarian function for a long time, so I think about that in the algorithm. But I think it's really more about how chemo-averse is the person and how much do I think it's going to add. And I only send an oncotype when I'm really ambivalent about the decision. So if a person comes in with a T1A tumor, I'm not giving them chemo no matter how big their tumor is as a rule with very rare exception. I don't send an oncotype. If a person comes in with, you know, an 8-centimeter tumor, you know, unless they're an older or it's low grade and there's some reason not to give them chemotherapy or have multiple lymph nodes positive, I'm not sending an oncotype because I'm giving them chemo. It's the in-between. And what I tell patients is I'm sending this oncotype to see, you know, I think you have a sheep and I'm trying to see if this is a wolf in sheep's clothing. You follow me?
Yep, absolutely.
And so I don't send it if I think I've got a wolf, and I don't send it if I know I have a sheep. I only send it when I'm pretty sure I've got a sheep, but I want to just make sure it's not a wolf.
So another issue related to adjuvant endocrine treatment is duration, and you were the discussant at the plenary presentation last year of the ATOM study looking at 5 versus 10 years of tamoxifen. How do you approach that issue today in your practice?
I think it's not quite the knee-jerk no-brainer that many interpreted from those data. So the issue about whether or not to add another 5 years of tamoxifen or beyond 5 years or any extended endocrine therapy, of course, is driven by the original risk of the disease. So anybody who is at higher risk of hearing from their disease in the first 5 years is generally at higher risk of hearing from their disease in the second 5 years and beyond. And it's the same predictors that we know of so far, you know, size of tumor, lymph node status, grade. And then it's really driven by where the patient is, how well they tolerated the therapy, where they are in their life, how much additional risk reduction are they willing, do they want compared to the tolerance of the side effects, if any. And I think it's a really individualized decision based on all of those things. And also dependent on their age, do they have a uterus? You know, because as women age, their risk of the bad side effects from tamoxifen, the really bad adverse events like blood clots and cancer of the uterus go up. And there was a 3% risk of endometrial cancer in the group that got the 10 years versus 5 years of tamoxifen. And the bulk of that was in the women under 50. So when I see my youngins, I say, you know, we'll talk about it. Right now, the standard is 5, but we could consider 10. And notice my semantics. I actually say the standard is 5. Can a standard be 10 right now? Sure. We have 2 randomized trials that say 10's better. But I find clinically that when I tell a patient, you're going to get 10 years of hormonal therapy, they feel like I've just sentenced them to a 10-year jail sentence. And so I don't find that emotionally that works. So I say, you know, we're going to do 5 at a minimum, and then let's talk about where you are and think about whether or not it makes sense for you to do more. And I find that that's much more easy to swallow for those patients. And that's the reality, because some of these patients are going to hear from it earlier. Some of them are going to come off earlier due to intolerance. And then some of them may change their minds over time as they go on about how they feel about the tamoxifen. That's a whole nother issue, because I think, you know, some women view tamoxifen as their power pill and some women view it as their jail sentence. And that can have huge implications for whether they even take it and how well they tolerate it.
One other thing I'd ask you about this lady, and I'm just curious in general what you're doing in your practice, and that is, did you bring up, I'm assuming she had normal bone density, but did you bring up the issue of bisphosphonates, and what did you think about the meta-analysis that was presented at San Antonio, and how are you approaching it in your practice? What did you do with her?
So I think the bisphosphonate data are really thought-provoking and provocative, and I think the issue about whether or not there's value added by giving bisphosphonate therapy to patients, particularly women who are either postmenopausal or have ovaries suppressed, which is where the evidence has suggested women may get some value from a disease standpoint, I think it's unanswered still. I think the meta-analysis is not as definitive as I would like, given that the AZOR trial was negative and the ABCSG trial is a very select population. In my practice, I actually do offer ovarian suppression with a bisphosphonate along with tamoxifen, a la the ABCSG12 trial, for select patients who have hormone-sensitive disease where we've elected to forego chemotherapy, but where I was thinking about chemotherapy. So this lady's a perfect example of that. And plus, as you alluded to, we know that bisphosphonates help bone health and will prevent the bone loss if we're doing ovarian suppression. And so anybody who I offer the ovarian suppression to, I will offer the bisphosphonate with all the caveats of I'm not 100% sure that it's actually going to help you from a breast cancer standpoint. The data just aren't robust enough for all of us to be saying we're adding this as adjuvant therapy. But at the same time, it's definitely going to help prevent your bone loss. So if you want to do it, we can do it. And I find that about 50% of my patients want to do it and some don't.
Well, it seems like, you know, every 6 months works, which is seems pretty doable.
Yeah, yeah. Although, you know, they're not a cakewalk, and there are plenty of people who have bad reactions and who really feel lousy for several days after they get the bisphosphonate. And so I am mindful of that. And I just had a lady come in yesterday who we treated according to ABCSG12, and she was just begging me not to take the last one because she's just miserable for several weeks after each one. And I said, okay, no problem. The old one's probably sticking around. So, you know, patients, you know, if we don't ask, and especially when you're in long-term follow-up, you don't see them, you know, and they think it's good for them, they'll tolerate a lot of side effects, many of them. And so this lady was pretty vociferous about it. And I was like, no problem. We don't need to do it. I'm not even sure it's adding, as you know. So I think we're a little, I'm just not always sure what the right thing to do is. I do always bring it up, but I'm not sure I'm always doing the right thing there.
Yeah, well, join the group. Mm-hmm. I mean, 17% reduction in mortality. So, I mean, you know, it's nothing to sneeze about, I guess. So let's finish out and talk about your 42-year-old woman.
So this 42-year-old woman, also a real case in my practice, presented with a large breast mass that was high-grade, ERPR positive, HER2 negative, and palpable axillary adenopathy. And so while we spent the bulk of the first visit talking about what we were going to do in the neoadjuvant setting for this lady, because we saw her as a multi-visit, she saw a surgeon, she saw me, she saw the radiation oncologist, I also made clear to her that we needed to make sure that she didn't have gross metastatic disease. I don't tend to dwell on that for a long time with these patients because, as I'm sure everyone listening knows, it's infrequent that people will have gross metastatic disease, even in this setting. In our study of young women with breast cancer, where we now have over 1,100 women on our study, only 5% have gross metastatic disease at presentation. And that's consistent with what we see in the overall breast cancer population. That's despite the recent publication that suggests that young women are more likely to present with metastatic disease. And that was a JAMA publication from this past summer. And I'm not 100% sure it was using SEER data. I'm not 100% sure whether or not the incidence of metastatic disease is indeed increasing in young women, or it's an acute recognition or a more acute recognition of something because we're looking harder in young women because we now understand that young women are more likely to have worse disease. But that aside, this woman did get staged, again, because she presented with clinical stage 3 disease, and she was found, unfortunately, to have diffuse bony metastases. And so then we were posed with the, you know, we talked to her about breast surgery and about all this wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, preoperative chemotherapy. And then you have to kind of backpedal and say, okay, we're going down a different algorithm now and treat her with the optimal therapy for someone with advanced breast cancer, which poses very, very different questions and problems and challenges for the patient and caring for her. I think the biggest thing this brought up for this lady was the age-old question of, should we give someone chemotherapy first, or should we go to endocrine therapy and save the chemo for later? The American Society of Clinical Oncology is now actually doing guidelines that cover all of breast cancer and all of many other diseases. So they're trying to do stem-to-stern guidelines, not just the boutique issues that ASCO has historically focused on for their guidelines. And so I'm actually privileged with chairing the publication guideline that looks at ER-positive, HER2-negative metastatic breast cancer. And we reviewed the world's evidence in a systematic way with a multidisciplinary group. And basically, the jury suggests that we should still be going with endocrine therapy first, unless someone is in visceral crisis, unless someone is sick and you think it's now or never to get their liver function tests under control. And that's what many of us have been doing and suggesting for many years, and many other reviews have looked at that and said that. And now we at ASCO and the group that is part of this expert panel have pulled together all the recent and more distant data and said, yep, that's still the way to go, at least with this phenotype of breast cancer.
Could you talk a little bit more about her primary? Were you concerned about the loss of local control as an issue?
Yeah, so the local control issue actually is a really interesting one right now. So this woman had a large breast mass that was disturbing her. It didn't hurt her, but sitting there looking at this breast mass was concerning, A. And then B, I'm sure you're aware that there are studies that suggest retrospectively that women who go on and have surgery to the primary, even with known metastatic disease, may do better and live longer. So I'm actually in the process of getting this woman enrolled, potentially, she hasn't committed yet, on a currently available study where women are randomized in this exact setting, meaning they have a breast primary that has not been treated, and they have metastatic disease, and they have to be responding to their first-line therapy for a period of time. And fortunately, this lady just showed that she's responding beautifully to ovarian suppression and tamoxifen as the first-line therapy. And if they're responding, the study randomizes women to upfront local regional therapy versus delayed choice of local regional therapy.
So about how big was the breast mass when you started the endocrine treatment, and how big is it now?
So when we started the endocrine therapy, her breast mass was probably about 8 centimeters. And when we saw her, well, we see her monthly, but when we restaged her this past month, it was much, much softer and ill-defined and not measurable anymore. So she's had an extraordinary response. Her bony metastases have gone from, you know, clear lighting up the bone scan to no further lighting up of the bone scan. They're still there on CT, but they have all quieted down. So she's getting a beautiful response, and we're starting to see signs of sclerosis instead of some of the lytic component that we saw before.